Chapter 5. The Gold Commission. There is no denying that the subject of gold is central to the issue of restoring sound money. That's because gold emerged from within the structure of the market economy as the most important guarantor of the quality of money. It was not chosen by governments, but by the market. The reason is easy to understand. Gold has all the qualities that we associate most with good money: the visibility, portability, high value per unit of weight, durability, and uniform quality. Whenever I talk of a gold standard, there are always people ready to accuse me of having some obsession or fixation. Fetish is a word thrown around. In fact, I'm only observing reality. The idea of sound money in most of human history has been bound up with gold money. Can there be sound money without a gold standard? In principle, yes. And I'd be very happy for a system that would permit markets to once again choose the most suitable money, whatever that turns out to be. I'm not for government imposing any particular standard. No central bank, no legal tender, no privilege for any commodity chosen as a backing for the currency. And yet the reality is that the dollar is money, even if the quality of the dollar is very poor. I've always believed that government has a responsibility to restore what it has destroyed. In the late 1970s, many people began to agree. I co-authored with Jesse Helms the legislation that passed in the closing days of the Carter administration to form the Gold Commission. The commission was not organized until after President Reagan took office. Of its 17 members, Louis Lehrman and Arthur Costamagna were the only others who were sympathetic to gold. The rest were anti-gold politicians, Fed members, and Treasury officials. Secretary of the Treasury Donald Reagan was the chairman of the committee and presided over our first meeting on July 16, 1981. Interestingly enough, that first meeting was off the record, without the media, and no minutes were taken. The plan to keep all meetings secret and without minutes was revealed to the public with the help of columnist Bob Novak and others, and there was a bit of a public uproar. Due to public pressure, a vote of the committee membership showed overwhelming support for open hearings. Henry Ruse, chairman of the House Banking Committee, attended one meeting and left in a rage. He couldn't stand 1 minute of serious consideration of the importance of gold. Before ownership of gold was made legal once again in the United States, which occurred in 1975, Ruse predicted that if it were to occur, gold would drop to $5 an ounce, and the gold bugs should be happy with the government propping the price up at $35 an ounce. He, of course, had it wrong. It was the artificially low price of gold that was propping up the value of the dollar, at least temporarily. By the time of our first hearing, gold had topped $800 an ounce. Ruse was not in a good frame of mind. He had been given a pro-gold newsletter by an attendee that prompted his outburst. As he left, he crumbled up the newsletter, tossed it, and let out a tirade attacking the commission's purpose. Let it be recorded that though there was little sympathy on the committee for gold, Ruse won the award for being the most hostile to the thought that gold could replace the wisdom of the Federal Reserve Board and wise chairman of the banking committee. At the time, no one seriously believed we were on the verge of restoring some relationship of the dollar to gold, yet there was deep concern regarding the dollar, inflation, and the very weak economy. The worries were great, but compared to the fear felt today, there's no comparison, and for good reason. In 1981, we had only been operating with a fiat dollar reserve standard for 10 years. Today, we've had the imbalances build up for 38 years. In some ways, the painful adjustments of the 1970s were helpful for the short term. The need for dollar devaluation was recognized. Fluctuating exchange rates, as disruptive as they were, provided a market mechanism that was better tolerated than the pretense of artificially fixed exchange rates. In other words, a token market mechanism was helpful to prop up a very fragile system. I recall vividly an event following one particular meeting of the Gold Commission at the Treasury Building. The Houston Republican delegation made plans to attend a Republican function in Houston, along with President Reagan. We were to meet Reagan at Andrews Air Force Base and fly on Air Force One to Houston. Due to the commission's hearing at the Treasury Building, which is across the street from the White House, my staff arranged for me to walk across the street and fly with President Reagan on Marine One to Andrews. That way, I wouldn't miss any part of the hearings and could still travel to Houston for the Republican meeting. On the helicopter flight, the subject of the gold standard naturally came up. "Ron," the president told me, "no great nation that abandoned the gold standard has remained a great nation." He indeed was sympathetic, as he was to many libertarian constitutional ideas, but he was also swayed by staff pressure to be pragmatic on most issues. Arthur Costamagna, a friend of Reagan's and a member of the commission, signed on our dissenting views with a minor qualification. Lou Lerman, later to run for governor of New York, signed as well. Then my staff and I scheduled a meeting with the president, the goal of which was to present him a copy and get a photo opportunity. The meeting was scheduled without a specific purpose, and I didn't want to surprise him with my plan. We called back to clarify the intent of the meeting. It wasn't too long after that that we received a call back from the White House staff saying that the meeting was canceled. The presentation and picture-taking never occurred. I'm sure Jim Baker and especially Don Reagan made sure that it did not take place. Don Reagan, as chairman of the Gold Commission, was the one who demanded the whole series of hearings be kept secret without minutes. The first report was filed March 31, 1982. The political system essentially works this way. Staff, if not perfectly loyal to the philosophy of the office holder, can block progress. Ultimately, though, the responsibility falls on the office holder to pick the right staff. Surviving the 1970s gave the dollar a reprieve and set the stage for one giant financial bubble to be formed over the next 27 years to get us to today. If, as a result of the Gold Commission, we had returned to our senses in 1981, the problems and grave dangers we now face could have been averted. Murray Rothbard argued in his testimony before the commission that it was not the gold standard that caused the depression of the 1930s, rather it was the misuse of the gold standard that led up to it. In the closing part of his statement, he urged that if gold were ever to return as a standard, it must be a gold coin standard where citizens have the right to have their paper currency redeemed in gold coins. Alan Greenspan also testified, and it was a rather decent statement. Although he did not call for a gold standard, he advocated issuing treasury bonds that were backed by gold as an interim step in moving in that direction. In 1981, he was not as strong for the gold standard as he was in the 1960s, but not as hostile as he became later on. Hans Senholz also submitted a statement to the Gold Commission. He, of course, was a strong supporter of the gold standard, but he was perceptive in not being very optimistic about it occurring in the near future. Senholz said, "They are indulging in daydreaming when they envision an early return to the gold standard. The fiat money forces are much too strong, and the public support for deficit spending yet too powerful to expect the currency reform in the foreseeable future." Of course, if support for deficit spending was strong in 1981, all we need do is take a look at the pressures today to spend money that we don't have. It will be a while before there is serious consideration for currency reform associated with a restructuring of the worldwide financial system. But the day is fast approaching when it won't be out of choice, but out of necessity, that we will have to face this issue. There will be no new gold commission, no open discussion regarding gold as money in the current administration. There will be, behind the scenes, the Fed and other elites planning a new system, international in scope and fiat in nature. It will not be smooth sailing, considering the task at hand. The countries with the greatest financial and military might will have the most influence, as the United States has had since World War II. Our military might remains supreme. Our economic strength is still first, but the trends tell us that won't last. Without economic strength and currency superiority, the military might well be steadily diminished. Although we'll not see a second gold commission, one more serious than the first, the intellectual fight between fiat money and the commodity money will rage, and the winner will decide our economic fate and what kind of society we will be living in. Paul Volcker was called to stop inflation and restore confidence in the dollar in the 1970s, which to a large degree he did. It was in 1982, when the Fed turned on the monetary spigots once again, that we returned to the boom-bust cycles. In some ways, the sophistication of the Fed in controlling necessary corrections created a false sense of security. Many came to believe Greenspan to be a great maestro of the economy. His reputation soared among Republicans and Democrats. Many, including Greenspan, believed that a new economic paradigm was upon us. There was a belief that serious economic downturns could be prevented by wise monetary policy, but their wise monetary policy had nothing to do with sound money or interest rates and credit being determined by the market. The economic planners literally believed that there would never be a price to pay for inflating a currency, manipulating interest rates, and monetizing debt. In reality, this sophistication in managing the economy was merely postponing the inevitable consequences, and it guaranteed they would be much worse. One of the wonderful products of the Gold Commission was our Minority Report, which remains in print today. Only 3 members of the Gold Commission signed it, but the full committee recommended to Congress to mint a gold coin. Since gold was legal to own by Americans once again, this was a concession to the pro-gold supporters around the country. In addition, it was meant to challenge the near monopoly of the South African Krugerrand being sold in the United States. I argued for a gold coin without a dollar denomination, stated as legal tender. I wanted people to think of money as a weight. My ultimate goal is to repeal legal tender laws. It's just as well, though, that I lost that argument, since some are now testing the legal tender status of this coin by forcing it into circulation at face value. By the time the coin bill was finally passed in 1985, as a result of our effort in the Gold Commission, I was no longer in Congress. I introduced the original bill, but I left Congress at the end of 1984. Later, there was a separate bill to mint the Silver Eagle. The bill authorized the minting of gold coins in 4 sizes: 1 ounce, half an ounce, quarter of an ounce, and 1/10 of an ounce. The 1 ounce coin was legal tender for $50. The half ounce was $25. The quarter ounce was $10. And the 10th ounce was $5. Do a little bit of arithmetic and you realize the quarter ounce $10 coin makes no sense at all. Those who made the final decision on the bill wanted it to be confusing. The 1 ounce of silver made legal tender for $1 further compounds the problem of defining a dollar. When compared to a Federal Reserve note, an old silver dollar, or a double eagle. Making the coins legal tender was ridiculous and nonsensical, and was done to guarantee that people wouldn't consider paying a $50 debt with an ounce of gold, nor would they do it with a silver dollar. I always assumed that the IRS would never accept for tax purposes true exchange at the face value of the new coins. But some enterprising and brave constitutionalists challenged this law in Las Vegas and paid the employees in silver dollar coins, and taxes were reported at the much lower level. Many paid no tax due to the lower minimum wage. As expected, it was challenged in court, and miraculously, litigants won their case in a hung jury. The silliness of our legal tender laws and the impossibility of defining a dollar convinced the jury that those charged did not commit fraud, and it was the confusion of the law that was at fault. We have not yet heard the final word in this challenge. I'm delighted it's being fought, and any favorable precedent may be helpful if an economic breakdown occurs and a lot more people do the same thing. But courts, as they did in the Civil War and the 1930s, have always ruled in favor of the tyrants when push comes to shove in dealing with the money issue. My bet is the government will not permit the use of new gold and silver bullion coins, that is, until the end the Fed revolution comes to fruition.